We're here at the Colorado Bowhunters Association Banquet. We have two special guests with us today for another episode of the CBA's ABCs of Bowhunting. I'm sitting here with COHA, Colorado High Altitude Hunters, Jermaine Hodge and Patrick Luttrell. How are you, fellas?
Good, good. Everything going all right?
Oh, man, things are going great. I love this day because I get to get so much information in like just a couple of hours, you know. I love doing podcasts. I love talking to people about hunting, but I get like a direct injection to the veins on the CBA banquet day. Actually, I'm curious what brought you guys out here today. I know that, Jermaine, you were doing a seminar on elk calling, correct?
Right, right. We cut a two-hour session of beginning elk calls from cow-calf sounds to, you know, location bugles, and then we went into Vance calls, your estrus, your lip balls, barks and chuckles and grunts. So the Vance calls were a little bit more in-depth, and I think the crowd liked it.
Yeah, I mean, it's always so fascinating. I listen to hours of people talking about elk calling, practicing it in my car, and there's these two competing thoughts in my head of like, you can just go out in the elk woods and make noise and things are going to happen versus knowing what things are going to happen. What are you asking an elk to do, or how are you asking them to respond to? And I'm curious, like, how you went from, at some point you never elk called. So how'd you get from that to giving seminars? How'd you gain your knowledge? And obviously I'm assuming there's a lot of field experience in there as well.
Right, right. So, you know, my whole background is wrestling, and I'm a part of the world-class athlete program. And right now I used to compete from 2005 to 2016 Greco-Roman wrestling for Olympic style wrestling. And then I laid my shoes down and I took over as one of the female coaches for freestyle. And so that challenge of getting out there and trying something hard, that's always been my love, right? And I love hunting. And what an opportunity to take on elk hunting, because I got stationed here at Fort Carson, Colorado. So the first year I didn't get a tag because I was too late. And then I said, well, I'm going to bank up and next year I'm going to put in for the tag, but didn't give it much thought at all. Sure. And then when I drew that tag, I said, well, I'm all in. And you get a tag, I'm all in. So I practiced from the month I drew that tag all the way to season, driving my wife insane. I had every Primos video hunting about truth or something like that. And every video I can get my hands on, I was popping in DVDs, boom, boom, driving my wife insane. She was like, I'm sick of you. She wanted to kick me out of the house many times. But that drove me to being somewhat good, like at least make some vocal. Yes, I could make some sounds. And then when I killed my first elk in 2006, then that drove me to go even further and dig in deep. I wanted knowledge. So YouTube's a powerful tool, and I would jump on every day. And what I teach now is it's a lifestyle of bringing in as much information into your brain until you decipher some of it, right? Yeah. So I was YouTubing everything, practicing it, looking at elk videos and real elk videos, not just hunting videos, real elk videos. What were they doing when they were doing it? What were their actions when they were doing it? And I was humanizing all this, like, okay, I think that bull's saying this, and this is why. So I started stepping my game up with diaphragms and using diaphragms, and then perfecting those calls, because I wanted to be not just, you know, average. I want to be above average because I wanted to be able to make those sounds and make them realistic as possible, and then put an emotion in it. So I took time and practice. And every year you get a little bit better because, I mean, let's be real. If you only practice this 1 month out of a year, then you're doing yourself an injustice, right? Especially when September comes around. So I took my game up just like wrestling. If you want to be on the Olympic stage and wrestle on the world stage and win medals, you can't just practice 1 month out of a year. Yeah. You got to practice every day like it's a lifestyle. And it really is. So I did this and did this. And then I was fortunate enough in 2019, my buddy Pat sitting here right beside me, he was like, man, dude, you're good. You need to go and compete in competitions. And so I did. I really didn't want to, but I did it for him. And then I say I got lucky, and I probably did, because there was a lot of people in that field that were super good callers. I mean, I could take it was probably 10 in the bracket of 32 that were amazing callers. And I'd take those guys in the woods any day with me. But went to Utah, did the world championships, and I think I tripped into the first place spot.
That's incredible, man. I'm curious in your determination, what's the difference between a guy who can make elk sounds and a guy who's good at making elk sounds?
Yeah, well, it goes back down to the practice, right? But it also you got to take time in the woods and listen to them and try to make the best sound you could possibly make in perfecting that. So practicing those exact same calls. And I use Estrus Scream as like one of my favorite ones that's so hard to, you know, make. Estrus Scream, Estrus Buzz, however you want to say it. And that cow is in heat and she has a little bit of to it. And a little bit of vibration to it. And that call right there, if you could perfect that call, you could almost do every call that there's out there, because that call right there took me a long time to.
The hardest vocalization.
Mm-hmm.
Still working on that.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a musical background. I'm a percussionist, and I've been in music my whole life. And I've recognized that matters. Like, these elk vocalizations are almost a version of music. And you can hear guys out in the woods who are too eager.
Mm-hmm.
Chuckling too fast, or on top of it, or getting short-winded because they're so excited about fucking elk calling.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an experience last year where on the second day of the season, the elk basically knew that there was 20, 30 hunters upon them in this 5,000-acre public land parcel. And so I just went to the very edge of public-private, and I saw five bulls off in the distance, so I got as close to them as possible. And I like to start with cow calls because I feel like it's a little gentler. And please step in if you have an opinion here.
Mm-hmm.
But my thought is, like, I'm not going to scare something with a cow call. You could scare something off with a bugle or a bad bugle, a human.
Right, right.
And so it was September 3rd, and they just weren't, these five bulls just weren't doing anything. And I started to put the math together. I was like, well, if five bulls are together, then maybe they're not looking for cows at the moment.
Right.
In the season?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I saw a thunder cloud coming in and some rain coming in, and I had a little bit of like Remy Warren in my head, like, just stay out there, don't be a wuss,
uh-huh.
I'll be in the field. And so I just started ripping bugles, and then they started coming back at me. And I ended up drawing, like, there's these five bulls, but there's this one 6x6. And I just started ripping bugles at them. And at some point, I see this, like, brown flash running down the hillside. And in my brain, I go, he's coming right to you. There's nowhere else he's going. He's coming right to you. So I dropped down my setup, like, 50 yards in front of where I was. And this is where my amateurness comes in. I was like, I was expecting him to come from one way. Obviously, he comes from the downwind side. And the grass was super tall. But I noticed in that moment that I was responding to him. I wasn't thinking about elk calling. I was fired up. I wanted to fight. I had that feeling. And it just made me have that, like, epiphany of, like, you need to embody the emotion that these elk are having out there. You need to be on the same wavelength as them. There's elk calls that are just calm. There's elk calls that are aggressive. There's elk calls that say, come here right now, mother. I'm going to beat your ass.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's what they're looking to do. And so I realized that, like you said, not only watching videos, not just hunting videos, but actual elk videos, or being out in the woods, is like when you can really experience it. One advice I have for people is, like, go to Rocky Mountain National Park and just watch the elk. See what they do. They're elk just the same. They're never going to get hunted, but they're doing elk stuff.
You know?
So that was some real insight for me. And, like, I have a long way to go with my elk calling.
Well, you know why those bulls were fired up after you introduced the bull, right?
Why?
It's because that bachelor group has been together for a little while.
So
they knew each other, right? Now you just introduced another bull that they didn't welcome into that bachelor group, right?
Interesting.
Yep. And usually I get more response off of bugles early in the season than I do cow sounds. Not saying that you can't pull them in with cow sounds in the early season, because I use both, but I use more bugles during that early season of the September month than I do later in the season. And then I use more cow sounds. Not saying I don't use both, but I use more cow sounds later in the season when those cows are in heat or being ready to be bred.
Yeah.
So that early season bugle can't beat it. You'll kill more bulls, or you'll bring in more bulls that want to fight early in the season.
I never put that together. That's a huge piece of insight there. It's like they're comfortable with the people who are around them.
Right.
So they hear a new noise that's not familiar to them. It could be a threat.
Testosterone is just starting to build, and they're just starting to get more aggressive.
And the same thing goes for those herds of cows. Maybe got a spike with them, but it's mostly cows and calves. And you throw out a cow sound, they might not welcome that cow sound, especially right. that lead cow.
Yeah.
She might just take off, and the rest of the herd might take off with them too.
Because she knows what she's going to be here.
She don't want to lose her hierarchy spot. And she says, you know what? That is not somebody we accepted in this group. And even if you sound as real as possible, that might be somebody she don't want to be around.
See, it's so fascinating. I was just talking to another guy on the podcast. Colorado, we have over 200,000 elk here. However, they're in groups of 50 or 100, mm-hmm. 150, and they know each other. They have it's a community. It's a neighborhood. And so you're really, you know, my mind's churning right now with all those thoughts of, you know, you could have two herds near each other, but they might not necessarily get along, or at least the alpha cow and male.
Or you got a resident herd and then like a
migrating herd
comes through, and that's where some of the big conflicts happen.
That's when the conflicts happen.
Yeah.
You'll see a lot more fights when those migrating herds come in.
Good to know those, especially going into a different or a new unit or a different unit.
Yeah,
kind of seeing where those migration patterns are and where the resident elk are, and you know, it just takes time, boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I noticed was early season cow calls tend to bring in cows and spikes.
Mm-hmm.
They'll respond to those. However, that's very interesting. That if you see a bachelor group. Together, that maybe that aggressive bugle will bring in and not only one of them, the most powerful one of them, mm-hmm. the one who's the leader of that group.
Right, and it could happen. It could very well happen. But I found a lot of my success early in the seasons are done with bugles.
Yeah.
Done with bugles. I bugle them. I mean, last year was crazy. Last year was crazy. September 2nd. September 2nd, we were out, and I normally can find a lot of these bachelor groups still just singles, and they're away from each other. Sometimes you find the bachelor groups together still, but those big bulls, those 330 plus bulls, they were by themselves, or the big 350 plus bulls had cows already early in the season.
And what's also interesting, though, is that was on one side of the ridge.
Yeah.
And on the other side of the ridge, there were like three or four bulls that were
still hanging out with each other.
Hanging out bachelor. So it was really different. Like I said, it was like an anomaly almost. Like, wow, you're not seeing them quite acting the same. And they're just literally less than a mile from each other.
Right, so right.
I'm curious about this, especially in Colorado. In Colorado, at any given time, you could drive 100 miles and go through three different seasons, right?
Right.
Spring, winter, and fall. Do you feel that altitude or climate plays an effect on how they're responding early in the year?
Yes. You could definitely tell the difference, right? So I'm going to give you this quick story.
Sure.
We found in this particular area, we found some elk, but they weren't really crazy going nuts. And I had my wife with me, and she had to tag because I was already tagged out. Mm-hmm. And so she drove down. Camped out that night, and then I took her out the next day, and I said, I found some elk, I just don't know, you know. And we went in there, wasn't expecting anything, so we really kind of dressed a little lighter than normal. It was cold in the morning, and it was hot during the daytime.
Yeah.
Well, that day, overcast came in, and I was like, okay, we shouldn't get no rain. It's not raining right now. Well, we walked into an area. It started raining, sleeting, and then it turned to snow, and a wet, heavy snow. But we were getting into so many elk, and the elk were going nuts, absolutely crazy. And I was pushing my wife and keep pushing my wife. But anyways, we didn't have rain gear or nothing in our packs. We wasn't prepared for this. So we're getting colder and wetter, and it was just nasty. But I kept pushing my wife. Come on, babe. We're going to kill one of these big ones. Anyways, moral of the story is that the day before prior, they wasn't doing that.
Interesting.
The weather when I walked in the next day changed, and there it was crazy.
Wow.
It was probably 200 head of elk, and maybe two herds kind of met into each other at, you know, later on that night, and then they went nuts.
Wow.
Yeah, they was going crazy. We never could get one. We had to get out of there because I was probably going to have to carry my wife out of there because she was getting to the point where she was just shaking cold.
We've even had instances like that where the weather, you know, was hot.
Mm-hmm.
Getting one-off, you know, encounters here and there. And then all of a sudden, what, a foot of snow came in, and then it just pushed all these animals like into a different realm.
So yeah, it was almost like they went into like a winter migration. Right. Yeah, I got stuck on a mountain one time about that. Yeah, I went in to hunt this area, and a blizzard came in. Anyways, it was elk all in there, and I said, I'm going in there. I'm a bivy camp. Now, listen, I don't like going bivy camping, but I said, I'm going to do it for this area. It's 4 or 5 miles in, and it's some rough stuff getting in there. So, it took 2.5 hours to get in there and set up camp, whatnot, go out that night. And I was hunting that area, turned around, came out of that area, got in my tent. They kind of warned me that a storm was coming in, but I dismissed it because the weatherman's only halfway right in Colorado, because you could turn your head one way and then turn your head the next way within 5 minutes, it's changed on you, especially them lightning storms. But a blizzard came in, and dude, it was so bad. I packed up stuff so fast, and I had to get out of there because I knew I was going down this mountain if I didn't. I wasn't prepared for that. Anyway, I took a 2-hour and 30-minute, and I made that joker in 2 hours. That's when it just started coming in. If I stayed there, it would have took me hours to get out of there. But it was at least a foot of snow to a foot and a half of snow at that 12,000-foot elevation, right at timberline.
It's very interesting to have to interface with your own level of preparedness, confidence, knowledge of yourself, knowledge of the terrain in these environments. Because you're absolutely right. Colorado, you can go from 9,000 feet to 12,000 feet and go from a bluebird day to a snowstorm in, you know, September, in July. Like, it happens. It's not always happening, but you can get yourself caught. And last year, rifle one, I was out with some buddies, and my buddy tagged out on day one. We were one of the only groups of people to pull a bull out of this area, and they were ready to go back. And I was like, I took off from work, I'm going to go still hunt. So I drove out to another unit, and I get in about 8-9 o'clock at night. You know, sun was already set. It was warm, maybe 60 degrees. And 3 in the morning, I wake up to like just pouring rain, torrential downpour rain. I'm in a rooftop tent on top of my truck, and I'm happy I put the rain fly up that night. And so I just put some earplugs in, and I go back to sleep, and I wake up 3 inches of snow on the ground. And
wow.
I was like, I'm not even hunting today. I just have to get my truck out of this situation, because I drove like 2-3 miles in on this dirt road, which is now just this mud pit. I ended up having to chain up my tires just to get out of this place. And it's that same thing as you go in with this intention of, I'm going to go hunting. And then you're like, I am now surviving.
Right, right.
I'm now trying to not pay $2,000 to get myself towed out of here.
That's right.
Very fascinating.
Yeah. That kind of sounded very similar to a story I got.
Yeah, things happen quick out here. I'm curious. My first entry into hunting was only about 4 or 5 years ago. White-tailed deer, Long Island, New York. It's a bow-only unit. And a lot of things guys talk about with whitetail, especially back east, is the photo period. Once they notice a shift in the amount of daylight is when that rut will turn on first, second week in November. It sounds like elk a little bit more respond to climate. And I was thinking when you were telling your first story is that they're going from 80, 90, 100 degree days in their fur coats.
Right.
It feels nice out. You know, for us, it's scary, but to them, it's, oh, we can expend energy and not worry about, you know, our livelihood as much because this is a more comfortable atmosphere for them. And I'm curious if you think that's why maybe they turned on when that weather shifted.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the rut is going to happen regardless of weather conditions. I mean, it happens down in Arizona. It happens in New Mexico in those hotter climates. Yeah, absolutely. Where it's freaking cold all the time, right? But I can tell you this. If you go out and you look at elk in, let's say, July or August, one of the hottest months, right? July and August. And you'll see those elk are a lot higher on those hills, especially, you know, some of your higher terrain areas. Shoot, I'll give you an example. I mean, we were down in Telluride some years back, and we were glassing up bulls at, shoot, almost 13,000 feet. It looked like they were in the rocks, well above tree line. Yeah. But there were some green patches, and they were just moseying up there. But it's a whole lot cooler up there than it is if you drop down, let's say, 6,000 feet. It's smoking down here, right? So they definitely respond a little different. And then I also come in a factor of where they are during the phase of September, because they're not the big bulls are not finding those cows up there. They're going to drop down to where the cows are. So the cows might not be hanging out with the bulls. They might be hanging out a little lower, mm-hmm. maybe those wetter areas. And those bulls have moved down later in the season to for the rut, sure. of course. But two is the water's down there too, right? Because as you get higher, the water's not up there, and they'll come down and water in those areas. But I think you definitely see a response from elk based off of time of the year and where they are in the cycle of where if they're up there at 12,000 feet and down. And then you also have a weather factor, right? You get, hotter days down here in Colorado. Colorado can get hot. You know, I know down where I live, it can get 100-degree days easy. Yeah. You know, high deserts. Yep. And it's dry heat. So if you put a fur coat on somebody like that, and if we had a fur coat on, we'd be smoking, yeah. right? So I think if you throw in the factor of cold weather, it feels a little bit better. Yeah. And now I'm going to move a little bit more. Yeah. I'm not moseying. I'm actually moving around. And you throw in the rut factor of it, you're going to have an incredible scene in Colorado especially.
It's fascinating. And last year was a really good water year, too.
Yep.
It was. The amount of vegetation in the place I hunted the same year before was night and day difference, which also makes traversing very different, too.
Yep.
Right? Your ability to move, navigate the landscape. I have a couple more elk questions, and then I want to get into the Colorado high altitude hunting. So the thing that I'm also noticing is there's some places in Colorado that hold elk that the maximum height of any mountain is 8,500, 9,000 feet versus 13,000, 14,000 feet. And I feel like the herd dynamics are just different. Not that you're dealing with necessarily different species of animals to that high level of a degree, but the elk out in Meeker are going to act different than the elk on the Continental Divide.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'm curious if you have any insight to, that may be too broad of a statement, but I'm curious how that plays into your thoughts in terms of the pursuit of elk.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at, statistically, if you look at it, those lower elevation areas, most of those elk that are in those areas are migrating elk that move into those areas during the hunting season, right?
Interesting.
And during the, the hotter parts of the times, they're not in that area as much. You still have resident herds that are in there, and they've learned to adapt to that area. But most of your elk that are in those lower elevation areas are the elk that moved into those areas. I find that more so for those lower elevation areas. And if you went back into those lower elevation during your summer months, you're not going to find as many elk. So they'll move into that area.
We'll find them in deep, dark pockets.
Yeah, it'll be some cool. And that's right. Areas. That's right. Sanctuary areas.
Pressure and, or near private property.
Mm-hmm. And it's and it and if yeah, on private property, of course. And then those areas have, it has to have water in those areas to hold elk. If it doesn't have any water, I promise you the elk ain't going to stay there.
Yeah.
So if they're migrating down to accommodate for the cows and stuff and find those cows, then they're moving in that area. And then they found safety in that area through the private land areas that are within that area.
Yeah.
And they'll stage up in those areas because they know there's hunting pressure that's doing that to them.
That's fascinating, because that's getting me to think about like how you play a migration corridor differently depending on different times of the year.
Absolutely.
Right? So if you're in that first week of September in a lower elevation area, you may want to position yourself on some sort of saddle that's coming from higher elevation.
Yeah.
Versus if you're hunting, again, like the Continental Divide, you may, early September, if you're chasing bulls, you're chasing them up high. But if you just got a cow tag in your pocket, then you're going to be at, maybe 1,000, 2,000 feet below.
Right? Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And don't get it wrong. You still have elk herds that are down low.
Sure.
Let's use Southeast Colorado. They don't have a lot of elk down there, but they do have elk.
Yeah.
And those elk are down there year round.
Right.
Year round. I mean, they're scattered out and they're hard to find. They're on a lot of private land. Basically a lot of the land down there is farmland and it's rolly hills. And it's not high altitude. It's like 4,000 something feet. and that Cimarron River that runs down the bottom between Texas and the Panhandle down there, where that river comes through, it's a lot of elk down there, but they find safety in those darker spots or those dried up river bottoms and stuff. And they do migrate down in there a lot, but they're resident elk and they stay down there constantly. So not to say there's not going to be elk in lower elevation, but I think if you look at September, for example, you find more elk in those particular areas if you're hunting those areas in that September, October month.
Hell yeah. I have one more question, then I want you guys to tell me about Koha. I know we had a short one today. I got to let you guys get on the road. How do you feel about guys who say there's such a thing as too much calling? You know, because I hear Corey Jenkinson talk about this stuff. I hear Remy Warren talk about this stuff. And what I've heard them say is, it's not too much calling if I'm trying to find an elk that wants to play.
Yeah.
You know, I'm never going to find a silent elk.
Right.
We just cover ground, and that's, you know, we're going to keep calling until we find the one that wants to play.
Right. Yeah.
And if there's some guy who wants to just sit on a water hole all day long and we're working around him, you know.
So be it, right? So be it. That's
we're not going to, you know, on purpose mess up someone's hunt, but again, at the same time, if we don't know they're there, you know, we're going to keep working ridges. We're going to go to the next ridge. We're going to keep working different drainages. And
yeah.
And we have our setups.
I think there's a time to say something and say it as best as you can, because I try to humanize, you know, elk vocalizations as much as I can, what they saying, when they saying it, why they said it, and looking at them and seeing what they do. But that's not my style of calling, not calling too much. I'm going to call.
Yeah.
I'm going to cover ground and call. So if you hear a lot of bugling, you probably ran into me in Colorado. I promise you.
Probably not. If you're so good, they probably won't know it's you. Yeah. That's the thing I've noticed is I've been able to pinpoint certain areas. I was like, I'm calling to another hunter right now. Actually, there's three of us that are all humans talking to each other right now. Man, I could go for hours with you guys. We'll have to get you back on. But I want to hear about Koha. What is it? What are you guys about? Give me the full, like, where to find you. What do you guys do?
So we created a little website. It's just kind of like an education website. It's kind of what we started as, like, not a nonprofit, but just a something that we can get behind and help support all big game hunting. For people and help, you know, try to cut down the learning curve. And our website is ColoradoHighAltitudeHunters.com. We kind of, you know, we shorten it to just call it Koha, but the website's ColoradoHighAltitudeHunters.com. And it's still up and works. We're just trying to put, you know, images up there. We're putting content in there. We have links to all of our social media accounts, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We also have a YouTube channel. We're trying to put educational videos on there all the time. I'm a school teacher, so I mean, I even have students that are interested in outdoors and hunting, and they subscribe to it. You know, we have videos on there from elk calling seminars, tutorials from different products that we've tried, on how to cape a buck, you know, elk calling competition live video, or videos from those competitions. Our kids compete. So we're just trying to always put things on there. And like I said, help people just cut down the learning curve.
Yeah, that's the big thing. I mean, knowledge should be free, right? You know, you shouldn't have to pay for every knowledge. I mean, well, school can cost a little bit, but for elk hunting reasons, and I'm just speaking elk hunting reasons, for Colorado, a lot of people come out of here from different states, spend lots of money every year, and they go back unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And if I was that person, I would be thirsty for knowledge. And so what I did is videos, content, everything that was free, I taught myself. So what we're trying to just compile a bunch of information where you can get it for free. All you got to do is click on the YouTube channel or whatever, and or shoot us a message and ask us and pick our brains a little bit. And then hopefully in return, you cut down the learning curve and you're successful.
But it's not just elk though. I mean, we hunt deer. We hunt mule deer. Mm-hmm. He's gotten some monster mule deer.
Mm-hmm.
We hunt with rifle, archery equipment. You know, we're pronghorn hunters. We hunt antelope.
That's right.
Bear. I mean, we're into all of it. So it's all big game. You know, elk is our favorite. But
absolutely.
But anywhere we can, like I said, help somebody out, give them a tip, give them a pointer, starting point. You know. That's kind of the whole premise of the whole.
And it's at its baby stages, but it's working.
Anyway, we just started this a couple of years ago, and And we're letting to see what it does.
Yeah.
Grow.
I appreciate it. Like, as a person who has no mentors in hunting that are like family or even friends, I kind of got into this because I was curious. Steve Rinella, Joe Rogan, John Dudley, Remy, these guys. And I'm so grateful for those guys to be your mentors, because my mentors, because it's some of the best knowledge out there, right?
Right.
They've done it. They have the boots on the ground experience. I mean, Remy Warren's podcast alone should cost like $50 an episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating.
Yep.
What he's willing to let you know. And it's out there. And I think you're right. People just want good information that they can trust. And in-state in Colorado, it cost me $75 plus gas to hunt an elk, right?
Right.
Other guys are spending thousands of dollars, their tags, their time off of work. I can go do this on the weekends and get into some elk almost every weekend. It's I'm spoiled with it, but at the same time, I don't want to take that for granted. And I recognize a guy coming from Texas, from Michigan, from wherever, almost feels like the money spent makes him earn or deserve that chance more. And he might not get it, or might start bugling in July or August and not do it in October and November and year round. You got to shoot year round. You got to call year round. You got to watch videos year round.
Right.
Lifestyle.
The excitement changes, right? I get a little more fired up about spring turkey time because then hunting's real, and then I got a pronghorn hunt coming up and really starts to build. But I try to maintain excitement in December, in January, and just say, you know what? This is what you do. This is the lifestyle you've decided to live. I love it, and as long as I love it, I need to take it seriously, right? We're talking about live animals. We're talking about animals that are bigger than us. And like the first time I ever took a grown animal, it made me feel super vulnerable, right? We're made of the same stuff. You got lungs, you got guts, you got a liver, so do I. And so I really appreciate that you guys are putting this out there for free, that you take it so seriously, and that you spent some time with us here today at the CVA.
No, absolutely. Yeah, it was fun.
Is there anything, Jermaine or Patrick, that you guys want to sign us off with or point towards besides Koha, you know, a YouTube channel, an Instagram page? Or
yeah.
Put all this in the show notes as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can follow me on Jermaine Hodge_Colorado. And then we also have that's on Instagram. And then that'll link up. You'll see a website page in there. And then just click that website page and it takes you to Koha. And then you can also find me and Pat on Facebook too as well, and then I'm sure I'm all over YouTube somewhere.
Awesome. Appreciate you guys. Safe travels today. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Absolutely. Loved it.